Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Obama's team grows, the U.S. economy struggles, and more rage over Mumbai in India this week. In Chicago, Hillary Clinton joined her campaign opponent as Obama's pick for Secretary of State.
I am proud to join you on what will be a difficult and exciting adventure in this new century.
On Capitol Hill, the big three bosses show up humble. Senator Chris Dodd says doing nothing for Detroit is not an option.
My concern with such an approach is that it plays Russian roulette with the entire economy of the United States. Inaction is no solution.
And in India, mourners for Mumbai's terror victims rage. Some want to attack, some want war.
We want attack on Pakistan. It's enough now.
We want a war with Pakistan.
We want a war. It's enough now.
This hour, On Point, our news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. Are you ready for a bailout? Should the big three get one? Is Obama building a team that can bail the country out at home and abroad? Joining us today from Washington is David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. His new book, The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power, is out next month. David Sanger, thanks for being with us.
Good to be back with you, Tom.
Great to have you. With us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. David.
And we will be joined in a moment by Alexis Glick of Fox Business Network. She's on her way into the studio right now. Let's start right off with some of those big three in Washington on Capitol Hill. We all saw them get grilled. They were much more humble this time. Here's GM CEO Rick Wagoner before the Senate yesterday laying out his plea for a bailout, saying his company was not perfect but worth rescuing.
We're here today because we made mistakes, which we're learning from, because some forces beyond our control have pushed us to the brink, and most importantly, because saving General Motors and all this company represents is a job worth doing.
A job worth doing. We're joined now as well from New York by Alexis Glick, Fox Business Network's Vice President of Business News, host of the network's morning show Money for Breakfast. Alexis, we know we had you running up the stairs there. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for being here.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here, Tom. It's great. It's great to talk about this today.
It's great to have you. What did you make of what we saw on display in Washington? They're back. The hat is in hand, bigger than ever. $34 billion now they're asking for. Do you see it coming out of this Congress, Alexis?
You know, I mean, listen, this story is so disheartening. It's such a terrible thing to watch unfold before our eyes. I know it's making for great theater, but I have talked to, not only members of Congress, but all different members of the UAW and families who've been working for the company for as many as 300 years over many decades of different family members. But look, I think the bottom line is the following. I understand a lot of the automakers have made a lot of changes in the past year, but they have so many legacy issues. And the problem here is we have to come to the reality of the fact that no matter what we do, the government is going to get involved in backstopping this industry one way or another, whether it's through a prearranged government bailout or whether, it's by giving them the funds now. And today will not be the end of the story. I mean, my guess is that this will dominate the headlines for 2009. They're built for much too much capacity, and they need to make adjustments. And the auto industry as we know it will never be the same.
Here's a tough opening statement. We all heard it from Richard Shelby, Republican senator from Alabama. A series of questions for the automaker CEOs, Detroit, who were there asking for that bailout.
How are their plans structured to adapt to an international market that demands greater efficiency and flexibility? Do the additional changes that they propose go far enough to ensure that taxpayers' dollars are being used to transform an industry and not just prop up a failed business model for a few months? Finally, how is the money going to be used, and how do we account for it? And I guess, lastly, how are you going to pay it back?
David Sanger, we know we've got a huge American industry teetering right before the nation's eyes here, but still so much ambivalence and plenty of resistance in Congress. What do you see actually likely emerging here, David?
If I had to guess, Tom, you're going to see some kind of a stopgap measure that would keep General Motors from actually declaring bankruptcy or being unable to meet its payroll. That's the short term of the next couple of weeks. the big question, and I think Alexis was addressed this right off, was whether or not government intervention can make these companies do what they have resisted doing for 25 years. You know, you and I both spent a lot of time in Japan,
yes.
And you recall that in the 80s, when we were there, the Japanese would come in to sell cars and try to sell American cars within Japan under American models, and they kept complaining about, whether or not the market was open. Mm. That wasn't the reason to be in Japan. The reason to be in Japan was to learn what the Japanese were doing and what competition was coming at them. And they never got that. And it's actually, a quarter century later, we're going through the exact same debates that we were all discussing then, which is astounding. And as if we have just discovered that there is something different in the way the rest of the world makes cars from the way we make cars.
There's a huge picture here. You quote David Mickey Cantor, the former U.S. trade rep who was involved in Clinton's negotiations with the Big Three in the early 90s, saying the problem right now is that everyone is trying to accomplish in a few days something that no one has been able to get the auto industry to do in a few decades, but something is likely. You say they may backstop GM, but who? Is Congress going to act? Are they going to make the White House step up somehow and get this done? Is the Fed going to be leaned on to do something, or what?
What I find striking out of this is you've a White House that has moved from no, you're going to just use the $25 billion that's already in the Energy Department budget. For the energy build for this. And you'll remember that was actually money that was just supposed to be for the retooling of factories.
Right.
Now we're just discussing using that same money to meet
payroll.
Right. So that's the first place they've backed off. But then the second question is, what kind of restructuring of the industry would the U.S. mandate in return for the money? And what I find striking is that President-elect Obama has been very vague on this subject. And in fact, you've heard in the past couple of days a few members of his own party being concerned that he has not come out very strongly in favor. He said there's a big problem here, we have to do something, but he hasn't said what. Now, maybe this is the one president at a time thing, but maybe it is that they haven't quite figured out how they're going to sell within their own party the kind of sweeping overhaul you would want to make as the conditions for this.
Alexis Glick, what do you see coming off the line here in Washington? I mean, the government telling Detroit what to do, a car czar people are talking about, what would that be?
Yes, I think David makes some great points. And let me add this, because we're talking about $34 billion, but let's be perfectly clear about this. Mm-hmm. I talked to the chairman and CEO of Chrysler last night, Bob Nardelli, just about an hour after he walked out of the testimony.
Boy, he must have been still sweating.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine I drilled him very, very hard.
Yeah.
But the thing we got to be clear about, particularly in the case of a company like Chrysler or General Motors, and these are the two that are at the most risk, is that they rely on their financing arm. Okay, their financing arm is bleeding. Now, Chrysler owns 51% of it. GM owns the other 49% of it. 75% of Chrysler's dealers use that financing arm to finance vehicles.
To make the loans to sell the cars.
Exactly. So when we talk about giving a company like Chrysler $7 billion, which is what they're asking for right now, the $7 billion is no good if they don't get access to the TARP fund, which they filed 4 months ago. So we have heard thus far from Treasury Secretary Paulson, you will have no access to that TARP fund. Even while he was in China, he reiterated that this morning in a written statement saying it was to shore up the financial system. And Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke is sort of nowhere to be found because he doesn't want to give the loans from the Federal Reserve Bank. So this isn't just about the money that they're asking Congress for. This is about the systemic risk to not even being able to have the financing for somebody to come in, even if they wanted to purchase or lease a car from these guys. Now, when it comes to President-elect Obama and his cabinet, there have been two trains of thought. Mm. One train of thought is that he's been out there. He's moved very quickly. He's brought the consensus leaders together. He's met with governors. He's
on
met
a lot
with
of
mayors.
Fronts.
Right. And he's appointed this independent advisory board. My guess is the reason he is staying away is because he wants to see whether or not the lawmakers right now can come up with some resolution. My frustration is the more the lawmakers sit there with them week after week, month after month, the more their credit situation deteriorates.
Yeah.
I want to know why the executives and the members of Congress who feel that they can get involved in this situation don't lock themselves in a room for 72 hours and figure out what that government prearranged restructuring looks like. Maybe it does require GM and Chrysler to merge. That is what is bothering me so much about this story.
It's just not happening.
How is that possible?
Jack, it's as though the country's kind of playing chicken here. But what do you say? Let it wreck or not?
Well, that would just be irresponsible. Nothing could produce a depression from a recession faster than to let these companies go down. And, you know, yes, David's right. There are these long-term structural issues with these companies. It's very hard, though, it seems to me, analytically, to separate what's happening to these companies now from the ambient financial crisis. People, as Elizabeth Warren reminded us this week in a report for the CBO, people can't get credit. If they can't get credit, they can't buy cars. And yes, there's these huge structural difficulties, but we have to also pay attention to the way in which the financial crisis is impinging negatively on the fortunes of the car companies.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Detroit begs again. Hillary goes to state, nominated anyway. Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State, right now goes to India. Saxby Chambliss wins in Georgia. Alexis Glick is with us, anchor of Fox Business Network's Money for Breakfast show, formerly an executive director at Morgan Stanley. David Sanger is here, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. His big new book, The Inheritance, comes out next month. Jack Beatty's here as well. Lots of talk about the economy. You heard the news. Retail sales worst in 35 years. Job losses, the most recent announcement, 1 month, 533,000 jobs gone. Here's Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson on Monday trying to downplay the importance of the announcement, kind of ho-hum, that the U.S. has officially been in recession for a year after that news had already helped spark a massive plunge on Wall Street.
We are in an economy that has slowed down significantly. The American people know that, and I think the American people have known that for some time. So I don't think that this is going to be big news.
Let's get a call from Ron in Augusta, Georgia. Ron, you're on the air. What do you see out there?
Well, I guess my question is, and no commentator has ever made this analogy, what's the difference between this automobile bailout and the airline industry? The airline industry went through the same thing. They had legacy union contracts. This allowed some airlines to go away. This is allowed...
And others to Chapter 11. Bankruptcy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the idea is that the same numbers, hundreds of thousands of people are working. Yes, hundreds of thousands of airline employees were working, too. And it allowed some shakeout in the industry.
Alexis, that bankruptcy path is described as calamitous. Why? Is it real?
You know, I completely hear his point of view because, believe me, I am just as frustrated about this as anybody. What the automakers claim is that if they were forced into a Chapter 11 type restructuring situation, that at the end of the day, the government would have to be the backstop because they would have to deal with the debt to creditors. Okay, so whatever the debt that remains that would have to be addressed in a Chapter 11 like scenario, and even when we've witnessed the unwind of Lehman Brothers, we're still witnessing it. So usually a Chapter 11 type restructuring situation could take a year, 2 years to work out all those situations. The other factor they talk about is the warranties. What is the likelihood that you'll want to go purchase a GM car if the company is in Chapter 11 bankruptcy, even if it's called restructuring, if the warranties are not backstopped by the U.S. government? On the other hand, look, the bottom line is we saw a similar situation to Chrysler in 1979. The government stepped up. They backstopped the loans, and they were able to not only return the money, but we made a $350 million profit. I think if we can do a prearranged type of restructuring, maybe we can get through this. But to just flat out say you've got to file for Chapter 11, then they might have some true concerns about the liquidation because people may not want to go buy their cars.
But David, this time you're quoting Dana Perino, White House spokesman, kind of indicating virtually no chance taxpayers would actually get paid back.
Yeah, and you know
why? Why not this time?
There have been many moments when I have sat in the White House press room and I have thought to myself, "Gee, the thing I'm hearing right now may not be true." But when Dana Perino said that, I was thinking, "Gee, I think she's probably right." You know, the chances that they wouldn't get paid back are probably pretty high. And I think there are two big differences between this and the Chrysler bailout. Mm. The first is that in the Chrysler bailout, I think everybody thought we did have a fairly decent chance of getting paid back, and we did. We made money on that. The U.S. government also made money on the Mexican bailout and on the Asian countries' bailouts. But in the case of the auto industry now, let's say that we back the loans. The U.S. Yep. government taxpayers go and do that. You then have banks that are going in to lend the money. If the banks looked at this situation, absent a U.S. taxpayer guarantee,
mm-hmm.
Would you loan them your money? Probably not.
What
given
money?
The current, yeah, right. Given the current business plan that they've got, and that's the big difference between now and the Chrysler bailout, which is absolutely nobody has any confidence that the business plans that we've heard so far have much of a chance of working. The remarkable moment 2 weeks ago when they flew in on the corporate jets, the ones that are now being sold,
yep.
right? And they sat down in front of Congress. None of the big three executives had a new plan.
Yeah.
And, you know, Obama, President-elect Obama, commented on this later on. He said he was sort of surprised that he hadn't heard many new ideas from them. I think they thought that they would show up and the money would be given to go into the existing business format, which clearly has not worked for the past 20 years.
Because we're in the bailout season. Jack, I know you've got thoughts here. Let me get a call or two. Gina, Columbia, South Carolina. Gina, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks.
Yeah.
I'm calling because I grew up in Flint, Michigan,
mm-hmm.
But I'm the product of a family that had no ties to the auto industry, even though I grew up and went to school with the majority of the people that I grew up with
right.
had their parents that worked for General Motors. And Flint, Michigan is just in great straits now. But here's my conflict, and maybe you can help me to
okay.
Not be conflicted. I've watched Flint, Michigan, and the work ethic and the sense of entitlement while making an inferior product and by clocking out 3 hours early and still getting paid, and the everyday nitty-gritty details of poor management. And yet my parents have a home there that they've been trying to sell that's practically worthless. So I'm
because those jobs are going down. Are you saying they were overpaid in Flint, Michigan?
I do. I think for the product, yes, I do. I think that there is a sense of entitlement from the General Motors workers that you. There are many people that work very, very, very hard and work their way up.
But Gina, what about the overpay on Wall Street? Huge bailouts going on there, and nobody really blinked twice about it.
Well, that's a very good point. That's a very good point. There, you've helped me not be so conflicted.
Well, I don't know. Let us hold that thought and get one more here from Bert in Clarendon, Vermont. Bert, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I feel about the same as that other woman does. I'm down here. I have a small family, two kids, and we're working hard. And, you know, we picked what jobs we went into, and we make the money we make. No one ever said to the big car companies, the executives, the employees are getting paid very, very well there and everything. No one said anything. Well, you've got these mansions and you travel around the world. That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But now suddenly when they have a little problem, they want us, the small guys, they're just working and going about our daily lives to bail them out.
How are small businesses doing in your neck of the woods, Bert? Not GM scale, but the little guys.
Well, they're going out of business or laying off the majority of their employees. Because, again, Vermont's a rural state
mm-hmm.
and it is seeping down to us. But I just don't think, you know, a company like that, that was totally independent and made money hand over fist, which is fine. Now they want us to bail them out. I think they should just let them go down, restructure, and then try to make their business like everyone else has.
What if them going down ends up making your life and others, they're in Clarendon, even worse?
But
again, I'm just struggling along with everything, and if I fail, I fail, or if people around me fail. But I don't think the car businesses not paying those executives and all employees that amount of money is going to really affect me in Clarendon.
I drive used cars. Yeah, you drive used cars. Well, here, Jack Beatty, there's a lot on the table right there. What do you say?
Well, I mean, I do. I would just make the point that you just made to him, Tom, that when you look at the spillover effects of a failure of these companies, Mark Zandi, the economist, was one of the people who testified, and he said, well, yeah, the companies are probably going to need a lot more than $34 billion. That had to be faced, maybe as much as $100 billion. But he said that is relative peanuts next to what the taxpayer would wind up paying, what the taxpayer in Flint, Michigan, in Lima, Ohio, in all South Bend, Indiana, all over the country, would wind up paying in increased AFDC costs, increased unemployment, increased all sorts of social services that would have to go to the unemployed in all the ramifying industries that come out from the car companies.
But you heard Bert in Vermont not buying that, saying, hey, who's got my back? Who's got the back of the small business going out of business down the street and everybody there laying off?
Well, unless somebody can buy something from that small business, unless someone has a salary, the small business will go out of business. And that person could, Keynes called it the multiplier effect, right? I mean,
you
if I have a job, I buy from you. If I don't have a job, I can't buy from you, and you go out of business. We are interdependent in this economy. It's a bitter thing because it seems to make mock of our individualist ethos, the idea that we rise and fall on our own and so on. But what did people say about these banks for months? Namely, we can't allow them to fail because they're too big to fail, because we have to have them. And now the issue comes up with industrial workers, and suddenly the abacus comes out, and people say, well, we can't do this, we can't do that. It's almost like there's a standard for blue-collar workers, and then there's a standard for the high flyers, and they're very different.
You know, I want to pull the curtain back in a couple of directions on the whole big economy, and then on the Obama team that's shaping up here. Alexis, first to you on the whole economy. My gosh, we've got problems. You know, the auto problems look big enough, but we got big problems standing all around them here.
Yeah, I mean, here's my point, and I totally concur with some of the things that Jack just said, and I understand what Bert feels in Vermont, but we are now at the point where, you know, what happened to the concept of your sort of your neighbor's keeper, right? Because what you don't realize about this situation, and this is something that worries me, is that at the end of the day here, what we're talking about with these automakers, if they go out of business, you know, there's $300 billion of different loans associated with these guys, whether it be commercial loans, investments, et cetera. If access to credit is bad now, just imagine for a moment what's going to happen to access to credit in this country next year, okay? Because when those loans go sour, it will be more painful than any one of us realizes. Small business owners, my husband's a small business owner, my father's a small business owner. Do you think they're increasing lines of credit? They're decreasing lines of credit.
So what would you say to Republicans like Senator Shelby, Alabama? You heard him. He said, no way, no how.
I spoke to Senator Shelby for 10 minutes this morning, and I said to Senator Shelby, why aren't you locking yourself in a room for 72 hours and coming up with a real satisfactory solution? Believe me, I'm not saying I want to give them the money. I don't feel that that is necessarily the right choice. On the other hand, I think the consequences are going to be much bigger than any one of us can sit here and estimate right now. And look at what we just saw this morning. We lost 533,000 jobs this month. That was the largest monthly loss since 1974. We have now lost 1.9 million jobs in this country, and it is going to get worse. If we think 2008 was difficult, 2009 is going to be just as difficult, if not more. The problem now is, can we really face the consequences of allowing an industry to fail? And the fact of the matter is, we talk about Wall Street and what we've done with Wall Street, and believe you me, I'm not thrilled with the TARP fund. I'm frankly not happy about it at all. I'm not happy about Treasury Secretary Paulson considering going back to ask for the rest of the money next week. But here's the issue. You think it's about the manufacturers, the auto manufacturers right now. I guarantee you there will be plenty more hearings in 2009 about a lot of other industries, because this is not going to be the be-all and end-all.
Alexis Glick writes on her blog, the data is stacking up against us. David Sanger, look with us then at the Obama team that's shaping up here, the Obama administration, you know, pre-taking the White House attitude that's emerging here. Wow, they are headed into some kind of storm. What, first of all, on the economy, what do you see emerging? Is there, can you perceive a kind of Obama take on this huge buffet of economic challenges?
Well, I think, Tom, that the team that he's put together is an interesting one, because it's not the one you would necessarily have anticipated if you just listened to the campaign. I mean, he ran the campaign not only on a theme of change, but also was elected with a reputation, whether it was deserved or not, as one of the most liberal voting senators in the U.S. Senate. He has put together a very center-to-center-right economic team. If you think of Tim Geithner, the new Treasury Secretary, of Larry Summers, who will be running the National Economic Council, we could go through the rest of the list. They are people who grew up in the 90s as the officials in favor of balanced budgets and basically moving away from deficit spending and so forth. And they are suddenly cast into this crisis where they know huge deficit spending is going to be required. We think that right now, before all of these bailouts of the auto industry and what other industries are coming down the pike, and I think Alexis is just right, if you start with the autos, you're going to hear from a lot more. We're probably talking about a $1 trillion deficit this year on top of an $11 trillion of total U.S. debt that we have now. So the first problem they've got to
That's amazing
is,
if you think about it. That's our total debt. We'll add a whole trillion to it in 1 year.
That's right. And so if you put that together, and then you put on top of this a group of very bright, good economic minds who brought the U.S. back to health by saying, we need to run surpluses, we've got an interesting cast. And then if you go over to the foreign policy side, you get a far more hawkish group than you would have thought from listening to the campaign. You have President Bush's current defense secretary, although he is somebody who I think may be more in tune with President-elect Obama than he was with his current boss.
Bob Gates, yeah.
Right. You have Hillary Clinton, who ran on basically the argument that that President-elect Obama was being naive in his discussion of how he would deal with Iran and other rogue states. And you've got, you know, a group of other centrists to, again, center-right. Jim Jones, the former Marine commandant who will be National Security Advisor, you know, did not make his name as the flaming liberal NATO commander, which was his past job. So you've seen a group here that is going to govern very much from the middle, although they have some very new ideas, particularly in the foreign policy area.
Govern from the middle, but yet they're facing a situation out there that's not a middling kind of situation, Jack.
Sure isn't.
No.
And I think that gets to the point that Alexis was getting at. We haven't defined what our objective is here. Are we trying to, you know, in the auto case, are we trying to save the companies? Are we trying to save the jobs? Or are we simply trying to buy time?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Dark humor this week, and the queen of American folk music rolls on home. John Stewart said last night Detroit's meltdown still looks better than Wall Street's.
Wall Street lost $7 trillion without selling anything. At least when Detroit loses money, we get cars.
Okay, President Bush starts his exit interviews, and Jay Leno gets in a last jab.
Well, President Bush opening up a little bit. He gave an interview to ABC News. Bush said he wished the intelligence on Iraq had been different. Hey, how many wish the intelligence in the White House had been different?
Bada boom. And music legend Odetta, once called the voice of the civil rights movement, died this week at 77.
I had a song, I'd sing it in the morning, I'd sing it in the evening, all over this land. Sing out of danger, sing out of war,
We are looking at a week in the news. Alexis Glick is with us. She's anchor of the Fox Morning Money for Breakfast show, vice president of business news for the Fox Business Network. David Sanger's here, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. His new book, The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power, comes out in January. Jack Beatty's here. Let's go to Fred in Atlanta, Georgia. Fred, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I have a hard time having any sympathy for the auto industry, but I think the problem is twofold. A lot of people blame the high wages and the burden on the auto industry by their workers, but I think that for years the government, with the lobbying of the auto industry, has relaxed regulations and accounting standards, allowing the auto industry to not fund their pensions, not fund their future obligations as far as like retiree benefits and things like that go, and got nothing back from the auto industry like concessions to executive pay or anything. I think the government is at fault, and I think that the auto industry itself is definitely to blame.
Fred, we'll look at that, but let us ask you, while we've got you from Atlanta, what do you make of the Saxby Chambliss win for the U.S. Senate over Jim Martin in your neck of the woods this week? Pretty substantial win for Chambliss. What's it say?
Well, I think everybody kind of knew he was going to win. I think he had a not a very strong opponent. I was personally disappointed, but that's the way politics are down here.
That's the way it rolls. Fred, thanks for calling. Let's listen to Saxby Chambliss for just a minute. This is after, of course, he came in so close to Jim Martin that under Georgia law couldn't take the seat in the November 4th election, had a runoff. On Tuesday, the newly reelected Georgia Republican Senator Saxby Chambliss told his supporters that he would protect them, Republican virtues, values, from an overreaching Obama administration.
When he wants to raise your taxes, when he wants to tinker with the Second Amendment, when he wants to make proposals with respect to health care that are going to take your choice of choosing your doctor away from you, then I'm going to be the 41st senator to stand up and say no.
I'm going to hold that filibuster line. We've got Fred's question on the table. Let's get another comment right here from Greenwich, Connecticut, and Joe. Joe, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Good day, Tom.
Hi.
This is Yadi. Reason for the call is my concern with regards to the recent Obama appointments is on the economic side with regards to Tim Geithner and Lawrence Summers. These are individuals who have been involved in Washington for, if you will, years and perhaps decades during easy monetary policy. We're currently in an environment where the easy money game is over. That paradigm is gone. So therefore, the issue of having access, whether it's individual households, corporations,
yep,
or governments going forward to easy money. So as we throw dollars at first the financial industry, and I don't believe we're done there, then the auto industry, and as we said earlier, what next, what other industries? How do we work our way through this with these current advisors? The breath of fresh air is an old voice, which is Paul Volcker's, and I'll take your information on the offline.
Thank you very much, Joe. David Sanger, how about it here, the question of party lines? We've got Fred in Atlanta saying, you know, with his critique of the auto industry. Then Greenwich calls in with a critique of Clinton Democrats coming back in under Obama. It's hard to figure out where party lines are going to run in the next few years as we face the economic challenges, just for starters, in front of us.
I think you're right, and you know, I don't think you're going to be able to divide this up along old party lines, particularly because the issue that Fred raised there about easy money is going to be more an issue of the Fed. And, you know, there you have a Fed chairman who got 13 months left in his term, mm-hmm, and was appointed, of course, by President Bush. And there's a lot of speculation that Larry Summers might end up in that post when it vacates, mm-hmm, and President-elect Obama has a chance to go appoint somebody. The big battle here, I do not think, is going to be between parties. I think the big battle here is going to be inside parties. You are going to have the split in the Democrats, which during the campaign was sort of a free trade versus more restrictive trade split, is now going to turn into a big deficits versus more caution split. And that's the rift, I think, to look for within the party.
Alexis Saxby Chambliss says he'll be the 41st senator to stand up and say no. But no to what exactly? Where do you see Republicans standing as they look at all this?
Yeah, no, I find David's points very fascinating. I talked to Governor Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota just a couple days ago about the meetings that the governors were having with President-elect Obama, and also talked to Mayor Michael Nutter of Philadelphia, two men that I like very much. And it's interesting, one, of course, a Republican governor, one a Democratic mayor. And Governor Tim Pawlenty said to me, listen, you know, I'm going to tell Obama the federal government is broke. You know, so while I understand even I am facing a fiscal budget deficit, as are 41 states in the union here, the bottom line is we don't have any money. And what we're doing is buying our way out of this to the point where not only we're talking about $1 trillion budget deficit, we're going to be talking trillions of dollars of budget deficit, which will make the recovery in 2010 and 2011 all that much more difficult. I mean, all you kind of have to do is look at what's happened to the Federal Reserve Bank's own balance sheet. It's gone from $950 million to well north of $2 trillion, and it could be headed to $4 trillion. This is a very, very complicated situation, because when Senator Chambliss says, you know, look, I'm going to say no, there are many Republicans who say this is about the free markets, and we've completely let the free capital market system in this country go. We've turned our capital markets into a socialist-like environment.
Under President George W. Bush and Hank Paulson, formerly Goldman Sachs, and plenty of Republicans on board in the White House, including John McCain.
Thank you. I'm so glad you said that, because where David is absolutely right is that this happened under a Republican administration. And so there will be so much infighting about how we continue to solve the problem. Do we do it through deficit spending, or are we going to put our children's future at risk because we haven't even begun to discuss in this country the risks of Medicaid, the Medicare programs, Social Security? Those risks could be the next subprime mortgage meltdown. I mean, right now, we've got to figure out how to turn the ship around quickly, but we've also got to think about the long-term consequences. And what we have learned from the first $350 billion is we were forced to sign off on this thing in 10 days. We didn't do our homework. We consistently changed the rules in the middle of the ballgame, and it doesn't appear as though we have a clear strategy.
We're not done with the USA here, but it takes place in the context of all kinds of stories and risk. India and Pakistan glaring at each other after those Mumbai attacks. Let's listen for just a second to India's External Affairs Ministry spokesman. This is Vishnu Prakash, demanding Monday that Pakistan aid India in rooting out those responsible for the Mumbai attacks.
Government expected that strong action would be taken against those elements, whosoever they may be, responsible for this outrage.
Strong action, outrage, lots of mourning in India and Mumbai this week, but not only there. Here's a sound of a rabbi saying Kaddish as bodies of six Jewish victims of the Mumbai terror attacks were unloaded from a plane in Tel Aviv on Monday. The emotion is keen right there. And in New Delhi on Wednesday, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said she had stressed to Pakistani officials that they need to help India in the investigation into the Mumbai attacks in order to ease tensions between the two countries.
I have said that Pakistan needs to act with resolve and urgency and cooperate fully and transparently. That message has been delivered and will be delivered to Pakistan.
David Sanger, do we have a kind of steady-as-she-goes anger here, or is there still risk of open conflict between these two countries post-Mumbai?
Oh, I think there's definitely risk of open conflict here. I think that, you know, Secretary Rice's trip was to try to cut that moment off by both urging restraint on the part of the Indians and urging the Pakistanis to cooperate in the investigation. But let's remember who the authors of the Bush Doctrine were here. You know, it includes the visitor to India and Pakistan, Secretary Rice. And what did that doctrine basically, you know, come out of? A moment where a terrorist attack was launched on the United States from an unregulated part of Afghanistan, a part of Afghanistan that became a safe haven. Well, this attack on Mumbai, we now know, came out of one of the safe havens that is within Pakistan. And the phone calls that the terrorists were making seemed to go back to the leaders of a group within Pakistan that had been created years ago by the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service. So if the Indians took action, you know, their argument is going to be, hey, we're just doing what you did after September 11th. We're going in to clean out an imminent threat from an unregulated piece of territory. Tell me how this differs from what you did in Afghanistan. And we're going to have a hard time answering that question. The problem that we're facing here is that the Pakistani government is facing three crises at once. An economic crisis. They just had to go get bailed out by the World Bank. Pressure from us to clean out the tribal areas, which are the border with Afghanistan, and now this pressure about the area around Kashmir. And you've got a government there that is struggling, you know, to handle, would struggle to handle any one of those.
Jack, I want to ask you about Hillary Clinton, but let's hear just a little bit first. We heard from her at the top of the hour. But here in a Wednesday CNN interview with Anjali Rao, the former president, Bill Clinton, said he would try to stay out of the way of his wife and the new president, Obama, on foreign policy decisions.
I mean, I really care about a lot of these profound challenges that our country and the world are facing. But the decisions will have to be ultimately the President-elect Obama's decisions. I'll just try to be a helpful sounding board to her, but I don't think I will do any more than that unless he asks me to do something specific.
Bill Clinton on Wednesday. Jack, what do you see in this new national security foreign policy team? Hillary Clinton right there shoulder to shoulder now with Barack Obama in Chicago and, of course, Bill Clinton in the wings, and plenty of challenges, as David Sanger points out.
Well, on Hillary Clinton, I think that her appointment offers the chance to popularize American foreign policy. Wherever she goes, whatever she says, she will receive the maximum publicity. She's a star. And the effect of that will be that a lot of people who don't pay attention, who haven't paid attention to what we're doing in the world, will. And I think all by itself, that's a good thing, because foreign policy so often is an affair of mandarins and think tanks, and it happens behind opaque language and so on. Hillary Clinton, her star power, will break through that. That is to the good. It is our foreign policy, after all. And second, I would hope that she could change the subject of foreign policy, at least at the margins. And that is to return the subject of human rights to women's rights in the world. You know, Pakistan. Nick Kristof, David's colleague, has been writing about the treatment of women in Pakistan, the throwing of acid in the face of women, thousands of women every year, unprosecuted cases from men who just felt offended by the woman or wanted to divorce her, or if the woman dared to ask to divorce him. These are ghastly matters. We are a nation where women have rights, and I would like our Secretary of State to be able to bring up such matters with states like Pakistan, to bring up such things in Africa where AIDS incubates behind a system of male supremacy, and to make this a vibrant part of American foreign policy.
Let's hear from one more soon-to-be former president here. Interview on ABC World News on Monday, President Bush gave a striking answer to a question asked by Charlie Gibson.
What were you most unprepared for? Well, I think I was unprepared for war. In other words, I didn't campaign. I said, please vote for me. I'll be able to handle an attack. In other words, I didn't anticipate war. Presidents, one of the things about the modern presidency is that the unexpected will happen.
David Sanger, President Bush has begun his exit interviews, and he's turning a lot of heads already. What do you think of what you're hearing?
Well, I covered part of that campaign, Tom, and I think I remember sitting through a lot of speeches where he talked about how he was the candidate most prepared to handle a terrorist attack. So when I heard that he was unprepared for war, I was sort of wondering what he was trying to tell us during those campaign speeches.
And of course, there's all the evidence issue. Alexis, you're there at Fox. How's it feel at Fox watching this administration go with so much trouble around it toward the door? What's the mood?
You know, I mean, look, I think the mood is the same that it would be anywhere else right now. I think we have witnessed probably one of the greatest elections of our lifetime, you know, one could argue easily in decades. And so I think that there is a feeling of melancholy, whether you're in New York or, frankly, whether you're anywhere else across the country, about, you know, what we're witnessing. You know, those Mumbai attacks were devastating. And I think a lot of people were glued to that story because it brings back bad memories of what it was like living through 9/11. And, you know, despite a lot of the things that President Bush has not done well, we haven't had another attack on American soil since 9/11. And so we can sit here and criticize a lot, but our lives have been protected. And I think there's this great sense of confidence around President-elect Obama about what he could do for this country. Mm. And right now what we need is we need some confidence.
Tough times. We will take them on. Alexis Glick at Fox Business Network, thanks so much for being with us, Alexis.
Thank you.
David Sanger's new book out in January, The Inheritance. Thanks for joining us, David, and Jack Beatty. Thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.